Hi, it's Len Testa from the Disney Dish Podcast. This is our second February show, and the second on the history of Disneyland. This one covers the time between early 1955, just before Disneyland opens, until 1959, when the park's already a hit and starts to see its first growing pains. It's really good. We've also got a special February bonus show for you over on DisneyDish.bandcamp.com. Because we're releasing this show on President's Day weekend, the bonus show has a distinctly patriotic theme. We're talking about the history of Liberty Street in Disneyland, Liberty Square in Walt Disney World, and the never-built concepts for Disney's America in Virginia. Some really interesting things there about how Disney's California Adventure almost used some of those ideas. Definitely check it out at DisneyDish.bandcamp.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's I, Len Testa, and this is our second February episode. Just like January, we're going to continue our story of the history of Disneyland. If you recall listening to the first episode, we did the history of Disneyland from the beginning of time, which started around 1901, until 1954, late 1954, when Walt is getting ready to open the park, which obviously happened in July of 55. To tell us that story, to continue on, from 1955 to 1959, is our own historian, Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Doing well, Len. Yourself?
I am doing exceptionally well. So, Disneyland's 60th anniversary, its birthday party is this year. Last time we talked about what happened up until the end of 1954. So now we're starting with 1955, right?
Well, we have to take, in order to go forward, we got to take one quick step back, because it's important to understand Disneyland's financials, because this is a big part of why things happened the way they happened.
Okay, and let me do the previously on the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish.
There we go. That's right.
I've been watching a lot of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and sort of towards them. You've noticed towards the middle of that series, they started doing a lot of cliffhanger episodes?
Yeah.
All right, so here we go. Previously on the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill.
Okay, and as you recall, Roy Disney had met with CBS and NBC, and they'd both passed on the project, but they were able to cut a deal with Leonard Goldenson, who's the head of ABC.
And ABC at the time was like this loosely affiliated chain of regional television broadcast stations, right?
Oh, yeah. Again, the joke I think we met at the last show is that that time this was a spinoff of the Dumont Network, and ABC, at least in the industry, was referred to as the almost broadcasting company. All right, but ABC knew that, you know, Disney could be the solution to a lot of its problems. So in return for a $500,000 cash investment, more importantly, a $4.5 million line of credit, ABC wound up with 35% of Disneyland. Okay.
Wow.
Okay, but it gets better, Len. One of the terms of this deal is that ABC would receive all profits from the theme park's food concessions for 10 years.
That's a lot of churros.
That's a lot of churros. Okay, but Walt, and now in return for getting this money, Walt had to agree to deliver a weekly one-hour television series for ABC. This is 21 hours of television for at least 3 years. So, you know, 63 episodes. But ABC's lawyers at work put language in the deal so that it allowed them to renew it for an additional 4 years. So basically they're locking Walt in for a seven-year contract. Plus there were options for two other shows, which turned out to be The Mickey Mouse Club and Zorro.
Who was the guy from ABC that negotiated that deal?
Supposedly it was Leonard himself, because, again, he had to turn around and go to all the affiliates and line up the banking. I mean, he was the one who really believed that Walt was going to be the guy that was going to turn things around for them, to get people to pay attention.
So he gets a third of the profits.
Yeah.
Wait. No, sorry. What was he got the profits, the concessions?
Well, they got all of the profits from the food concessions for 10 years. That was the language of the deal.
So a third of the gate profits.
Yep. Now the interesting thing is Roy at least built language into the deal. He pushed back, and Roy built in language that would allow them to eventually buy out ABC, which, okay, when we get to the early '60s, we'll discuss. But, you know, because, you know, that Roy was had been turned down by CBS and NBC, ABC was really in a primo position to get huge demands out of you know, the concessions out of Disney, and
there
they did.
There were no more networks, right? There wasn't a Fox, there wasn't a CW,
no,
right? There's
no, I mean,
networks. There were two and a half, anyway.
You know, beyond that, it was Walt going door-to-door with puppets, you know. So, all right. So, now, just again, circle back to the finances. So, when you factor in the $500,000 that Walt Disney Productions itself put up to help fund Disneyland, and, again, the way Roy wrote the deal, that then gave the company 34.48% of Disneyland. The $250,000 that Walt himself put up by selling his life insurance and, you know, that taking in lots of loans out in his house, that gave him 16.55%. And then $200,000 that Western Publishing, they're the folks who handle Disney's comic books and that sort of thing,
yep,
they put up. That gave them 13.8% of Disneyland. So at this point, Walt has just shy of $6 million to build Disneyland.
Wait, $200,000 got them 13% of Disneyland?
Yep. Well, you know, just you have to understand it was, you know, again, Walt needed money, and they
this was fire sale prices. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, so Walt now has just shy of $6 million. He needs seven. So this is where C.V. Wood comes in, and it's C.V. Wood Jr. or Cornelius Vanderbilt Wood Jr.
It sounds like he should be on a riverboat.
He should be. He was, you know, that he was the necessary element here. He was, you know, Walt was the creative, and C.V. was an unvarnished salesman, very much in the style of Harold Hill. I mean, he went out, you know, he went out and found money and sold Disneyland in as many different directions as he could. And, for example, he got an agreement out of the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe Railroad. They signed up.
How could you say that without singing it, Jim?
You know, but he got $50,000 a year out of that train company in exchange for the, you know, for them having the rights to put the name Santa Fe and the company logo on all of Disneyland's trains, the stations, any literature, that sort of thing. At the same time, you know, Walt wanted to build this recreation of, you know, a Main Street, and you had to fill those shops. So, you know, CV was the one who went out and convinced, you know, Eastman that they wanted to come to fund the Camera Center and
just film and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know, you convinced the Wurlitzer Organ people that, you know, people will come to this park and they'll come into your shop and hear the organ play, and they really will then buy an organ, which you'll then have to figure out how to bring home from Anaheim.
That's what the package pickup is for.
There you go. And, you know, Bank of America, Gibson greeting card. In fact, I've got I'm actually holding in my hands now. These are, you know, the old fashioned heavy fiber paper. You know, these are typewritten things from April 25th, 1957. This is the list of every Disneyland sponsor, if you want to know the capacity of the hourly capacity of the Jungle Cruise back then. They could
really?
2,112 people per hour.
That's a lot of people back then.
It was. 67% of the gate did the Jungle Cruise back in the day. But
Where did this come from? This is from CV?
This is actually from CV's company that he formed after he left Disney, a company called Marco Engineering. I was lucky enough to work with some folks who, you know, sort of got in. Marco shut down in the early 90s, and it was one of these things where the people, you know, in the offices were like, you need to clear all this stuff out by the weekend because we have new clients coming in. And just some amazing theme park history, you know, was being tossed into the dumpster, and I was able to filter some of this stuff out as I was helping clear out the offices. But
okay, so CV's going. At this time, it's 1954, early 1955. CV's going door to door to get money from Wurlitzer Organs. Did you have a list of like the people that he hit up? I mean,
The
organ thing is a little unusual, but I totally get the.
Well, well, for example, you know, CV was the one who went to the American Dairy Association and convinced them to open the dairy bar in Tomorrowland. Like, I mean, he went everywhere. He talked to Maxwell House to coffee. Sponsor the coffee shop and, again, to pay fee to do that. He went after Coca-Cola to run the refreshment corner. On Main Street. But what's interesting is he was able to also cut a deal with Pepsi-Cola to sponsor the Golden Horseshoe, which, again, gives you some idea of...
this guy's good.
Yeah. Did I not mention that Pepsi's also in the park?
Bring your kids.
There you go.
So, all right. So he's going to these places. We've all been in the theme parks, hundreds of times. So the idea that you're selling film... seems natural. The idea that you're selling Coke seems natural. But did he at the time, he didn't have any statistics to back this up. The idea of Disneyland is entirely
open.
He goes into these companies and what does he say? I mean, trust me, or trust Walt and give me 50 grand.
It was kind of selling the sizzle before there was a steak. I mean, for example,
we haven't even brought Mommy and Daddy Cow together to make the steak yet.
Right. But it's just, some of the people, I mean, are just fascinating. For example, the Bluebird Shoe Company. I mean, they're little on Main Street. Mm-hmm. There was a store that sold children's shoes. And the way CV did it, it's like, well, look, that's families come to Disneyland and they'll come and the kids, the kids' feet will hurt and you can, that they'll cramp their feet. You can sell shoes. The one that fascinates me is Hollywood Maxwell. He actually convinced a corset, and the term they use is torsolette.
Torsolette.
There you go. So in other words, small corset. Bras, panties, the works. He convinced them to come into Main Street USA. And actually, not only that, they paid for a Disney-produced show that you'd walk to the back of the store, and the Wizard of Bras would tell you the histories of women's lingerie.
Sort of like a predecessor of the Victoria's Secret lingerie show that's every Super Bowl, right? I'm sure it's all like that.
Yeah, in kind of a Jane Russell sort of way. So
he goes to this corset maker. They do the Wizard of Bras, which, by the way, I think is a great name. Mm-hmm. And then they have to go put it in. So how does he goes back to Walt and said, Walt, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. Good news is I got you a sponsorship. Bad news is we're doing a bra show, a lingerie show on Main Street. What's Walt's take on this, or what's Roy's take on this?
They can't say no at this point, because what's happening is that in the process –
it's like, I don't want to know.
Because the thing is, Disneyland's price, they get a construction price, jumped from $7 million to $11 million to $15 million, eventually topping out at $17 million. And, in fact, I've had veteran Imagineers tell me that the real construction price of Disneyland was actually $18 million, because a week after the park opened, somebody found a roll-top desk. That, just the thing had been pulled down. They opened up, and here are all of these bills that have never been paid, that have just sort of stuff it in there. We'll deal with it after it's open. And it's just one of these things where it's like, honestly, any other company would have been killed. I mean, that given the way this project was bleeding money, you also have to understand that. Walt is busy at the same time trying to figure out how to do these 21 hours of television per season. He's also at the very same time doing their most expensive live action film ever, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Wow. Yeah.
This is a bad, bad time for the company. And honestly, Disney probably would have been taken down by all of these things if it hadn't been for Davy Crockett. Okay.
Davy Crockett.
Okay.
So you're talking about the we all know how it ended up with Coonskin Caps, but this is early 55 and we haven't
mentioned. Well, actually the first episode, there were a total of 3 that were produced in 54, 55. There was the first aired in December 15th, 1954.
And late 1950, and this was on ABC?
Yeah. Now, again, to give you some idea of the size of the audience that was watching Disneyland at this time. And again, this is one of the things on Disneyland, on ABC side of the fence, this gamble paid off huge. The first episode, when it aired in October 27th, 1954, 30 million people, to be exact, 30.8 million people tuned in to that episode. All right. There's no show on today. Not even the Super Bowl does that sort of numbers. So, you know, that many people tuned in for this show.
Wow. And this is the mid-50s. Not that many families have televisions.
No. In fact, you know, they had the phenomenon of friends actually going over to friends' house to watch the Disney show. And you know, And Crockett just took off. Depending on who you talk to in the company, it was definitely a cash cow. All right, but by the end of 55, over $300 million worth of Davy Crockett merchandise had been sold. That's $1 billion in 2015 money, Len.
Wow. Yeah. So just some quick statistics here: 30 million viewers for Davy Crockett would put it in the top 15 TV episode finales of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So the finale of Everybody Loves Raymond is the number 15 title, according to Wikipedia, of all time, which hit just under 33 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about – now, MASH hit 125 million people, but the population of people who had televisions was much, much larger. Yeah, so 30 million people, you're talking about – you're probably talking about like half the number of people that had televisions in the United States.
No, absolutely.
Audience share.
Yeah, and every little kid in North America wanted a coonskin cap. Now, to be clear here, because Davy Crockett was a historic figure and really couldn't be copywritten by Disney, there was a lot of unauthorized stuff out there. But of the $300 million worth of merch that was sold, depending on who you talk to, it's $20 or $30 million that poured into the company's coffers just when they really needed this dough. When they were scrambling to fund the construction of Disneyland, the fact that they suddenly had this other cash revenue was killer for them. And meanwhile, ABC is just, you know, loving, just the numbers that are producing. In fact, they turned around and they started hyping the opening of Disneyland because they were going to be airing the 90-minute special on July 17th. And there was such interest in that broadcast that by March 13th of 1955, ABC had sold all of the advertising time.
Wow, so March, April, May, June, July. So 4 months in advance.
Yep.
But for a completely different thing. But for a Disneyland thing. So it was just the power of the Disney brand.
Yeah. And now, mind you, that it did look pretty dicey there for a while. I mean, ABC would bring its crews in every Sunday the 6 weeks prior to the opening, mm-hmm. and stage rehearsals, but toward the end, Disney was running crews 7 days a week, virtually 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you know, you've got your plumbing strike, you've got your asphalt workers strike, but again, Davy comes through, you know, that they take the three episodes that had previously run on television, put them in theaters on May 25th, and bang, there's another cash cow. And then just less than 4 weeks later, Lady and the Tramp is released to theaters, and that's a big hit. And so Walt is just – any money that's coming in at this point is going straight into Disneyland.
So I hear there's a story about – speaking of Davy Crockett, that – there was the contract that Fess Parker had was supposed to cut him in on a percentage of the merch sales.
Yeah. And that – the toughest part of that thing is, as it turns out, Fess's contract wasn't with Disney Productions. It was with Walt himself. And evidently that's what led to – you know, Fess being basically cut out of things in fact, it was really a bone of contention. In fact, Fess took him a long time to start coming out for Disney events, mostly because he felt he should have gotten a bigger share, or at least, you know, I mean, he was paid to do the things, and he had a pretty decent film career at that point. But again, he was under contract to work for Disney, so he was doing Old Yeller, he was doing Westward Ho the Wagons. He, you know, he couldn't really go anywhere else. And it honestly wasn't till the mid 1960s when, you know, he, after seeing Walt cash in forever, or Disney cash in forever on Davy Crockett, that he started the Daniel Boone television series. And, you know, that's how Fess eventually got his Davy Crockett money. He just basically put on another coonskin cap and played the exact same character, but this time for NBC.
Okay.
You know, and what was kind of interesting is at that point, both Fess and Walt were working for NBC because Walt had moved the Disneyland television show over to NBC and turned it into The Wonderful World of Color.
All right, so we'll have to do a different different show on that. Okay, so it's early, it's spring of 55.
Mm-hmm.
Davy Crockett's hit, Lady and the Tramp is hit. They're flush with money. We're 6 or so weeks out from opening Disneyland.
But at the same time, they're coming up against things that, you know, for example, they do the first test run of Casey Jr. And
The little train, the model train.
The little train. And they have a 25% grade on the thing. And they're taking it up the first hill, and the engine almost tips over backwards onto the train.
A 25% grade on a train track?
On a train track. Because, again, this is the little train that I think I can.
Well, yeah, so, I know, but it's not going to break. So, I mean, generally, a 3 or 4% grade on a train,
mm-hmm.
you know, an uphill pitch of 3 or 4% is a lot for a train. So 25% is like not even – there's no train track in the world that's 25%.
Well, they cheat it. They put lead weights – they add them to the front to give it an additional, you know, the reason to hold down. And that allows it to work long enough for the television special. In fact, that's where it gets kind of interesting. The July 17th broadcast, there is so much stuff on that show that, you know, for example, Danny Thomas's family are shown coming out of the you know, the Rocket to the Moon ride. And, oh, man, we had a great time on that attraction. And they show you a clip of what the ride is like. What they don't then mention is that it didn't open that day. It didn't open till July 22nd.
it worked one time.
It's likewise, worked once. Casey Jr. runs once for the TV channel. In fact, Jerry Colonna, the voice of the Mad Hatter, from Alice in Wonderland, is driving the train. It runs as long as the television cameras are on. And then it gets shut down, and it takes them till July 31st to have regraded, you know, the Casey Jr. and get it the way it's going to open.
Wow.
You know, the pirate ship that eventually became the Chicken of the Sea restaurant looks wonderful on camera. But they'd only painted the half that faced the camera. I mean, just over and over and over again, you know, that there were all these cheats just to show that Disneyland was this, you know, wonderful place and you had to come. And but again, they get it open, you know, and the very next day it opens to the public. And just to put these things in perspective, folks, admission at that point was $1 for adults, 50 cents for kids. And there were only a total of 20 attractions, but every attraction you had to dig out between 10 cents and 35 cents to board these things. And that really did become a bone of contention. In fact, that was one of the things that people, you know, the first summer, that was the complaint. It just felt like at Disneyland, no matter where you were opening your wallet.
Yeah.
And so what they decided to do, starting in September, they began the ticket books. You know, we're all familiar with these. You know, the notion, the ABCD tickets.
Tickets, yeah.
Yeah. And that did, in fact, they officially came out online in October 11th, 1955 was the first day they were sold.
Okay.
And this was just a week after the Disneyland Hotel had opened. And again, you know, hotel was being kind. It was a motel. It was 100 rooms. And guess how much to stay a night, Len?
Disneyland Hotel, 1955.
Right.
So it's $1 to get in. Mm-hmm. I'll say, I could be wrong here, 25 a night?
Actually, 15. You're very close. But, you know, just it's now Walt is trying to learn how to run a Disneyland. And, you know, so, you know, they've not got a place for people to stay. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he's the one thing they keep coming up against is, you know, how do you work crowds? I mean, for example, as hard as this is to believe, when the Jungle Cruise opened, it didn't have a queue.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I've
never heard this.
Yeah, the queues actually had to be invented on the fly, because the whole notion of, well, people are going to line up, and it's, well, where the hell is that line going to go? Oh, it's going out to the hub. It's like, we can't have that. Well, it's like, you know, and this whole notion of, well, how do we actually operate this thing? They everything had to be learning.
Really? So it's a Jungle Cruise, which 2,000 people an hour,
right?
To 2,100 people an hour, we figured out. It didn't have a queue.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't – so what? You know, now when we go through it, you know, we go onto a Disney ride, there's this transition experience, which is the queue itself, right? Which sort of – now we know a queue tells you a story. It gets you in the mood. It provides you sort of the visual language that you'll see on a ride. But you're saying there was none of that when the Disneyland first opened?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, they just and to be fair, some of this was finished so late. And, you know, I mean, they just basically threw open the doors and, you know, people came in, and then it's like, oh, crap, go get some chains, go get some poles, you know, and let's figure out how, you know, to get people to line up.
So they get the ropes and chains and they make an orderly line. But when did the – was it in 55 that they said, you know what, we're going to need a formal line here, and while we're at it, we should use this time that they're going to wait to introduce them to the concept of the ride?
Actually, they were more concerned at that point about making sure that the guests had the right ticket. You know, the God help you that if you were getting on a C ticket and you made your way all the way through the line and only had an A ticket. So, you know, they started the first spiels were, were more about not so much the ride as be sure that you have your B ticket for the, you know, the omnibus or, you know, that sort of thing.
And so how did they deliver these? Was it just was it a recorded loop?
Well, you know, that was the thing, that initially it was some poor teenager who kept saying this over and over again. And eventually Walt, who'd come to the park every weekend and walk it and realize, ooh, we need to do better show here, and would then hire somebody to write the script and then record the loop. And then, there it was. But at the same time, this is a guy who's trying desperately to come up with new rides for his park to handle the additional capacity. I mean, for example, based on how well the first three Davy Crockett movies did, or the television shows that were then turned into the King of the Wild Frontier movie, Walt actually put two additional Davy Crockett films into production, or TV episodes, excuse me. The Davy Crockett Keelboat Race, which aired on ABC television November 16th of 55, and then the follow-up episode, the Davy Crockett and the River Pirates, which aired December 14th, 1955. Now, again, here's what's cool, okay? That episode, the second episode, the you know, and these two episodes are basically Davy Crockett paired with Mike Fink. All right. Second episode is December 14th. If you went to Disneyland on December 25th and walked down to the Rivers of America, what do you see? The two actual keel boats that were used in the making of this TV series that are now a ride. All right.
Wow. And I've been on them. You've been on them too, no doubt.
Well, then, well, actually, the interesting thing is that they actually were eventually replaced by larger boats because they were so popular.
Oh, really? But you've been on the ride.
Yeah. But you know, again, it's this whole notion of you needed, you know, we need capacity. Get me the boats. Bring them back to Anaheim. We're throwing them in the water.
I didn't – in the last 5 minutes, we've gone over the fact that there weren't queues at the rides, the origin story of spiels, and then the Mike Fink keelboats, which I didn't – I mean, I knew they were there, but I never knew what the story was that how they came about. That is super interesting.
Well, and where this gets – particularly interesting is starting in January of 56, Walt suddenly finds himself having competition. I mean, it wouldn't loom over the horizon immediately, but it was coming.
56.
Depending on who you talk to, You know, again, C.V. Wood was the guy who found the money that made Disneyland possible in those last scary months. But the park's up and running. It's clear it's going to be a financial success at this point. It's now – money isn't a problem. Capacity is a problem.
Okay.
And C.V. – Walt and C.V. start to get on each other's nerves, and Walt eventually decides, look, you know, it's built. I don't, you know, it was nice to have a project manager. It's built. I'm now going to finesse it. I'm going to let C.V. go. Now,
he's not going to find another role for him inside the company.
No. And in fact, supposedly that the depending on who you talk to, CV, evidently Walt showed up at Disneyland one day. And again, this is the general manager and vice president of Disneyland, and shows up at CV's office, and CV's on the phone talking about how he built the park, how he, you know, found the money. And this just rubbed Walt the wrong way. So he just said, look, you know, thank you for your help, and, you know, let's just part friends. And CV goes, uh-huh. This is a Friday. And CV, you know, again, in today's corporate world, you know, you'd get walked out to the parking lot, and you'd have your bag of personal belongings and sent on your way. Where CV cleaned out his entire office, as in his Rolodex with the contacts of everybody he'd ever worked with to do the parks. All of the letterhead, you know, that every letter from every vendor. And, you know, this is a Friday. By Monday morning, he set up Marco Engineering. And as the master builder of Disneyland, he now announces that he and his expertise are available to build, you know, Disneyland-like attractions around the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, Walt has this history with his employees of keeping them around forever and then finding new things for them to do. But apparently, it must have been something – there must have been a really big personality clash between him and CV for him not to keep CV around.
Well, again, you know, to face it, there is, you know, there's kind of a famous story about the animator and artist Ken Anderson, the gentleman who worked on a lot of Disney films. And, you know, Walt loved what Ken did, you know, just loved it. But he said, look, you know, you're a great artist, you're a great talent, but you have to understand that everything you do is going to have my name on it.
Right.
You know, and as long as you're comfortable with that, you can have a great career here. But you were not in the Ken Anderson business. You were in the Walt Disney business.
Yeah, okay.
You know. All right. And now, speaking of which, it just kind of an insight into, you know, this has just gone on. But on January 25th, 1956, Walt sits down with the Disneyland Merchants Association, all these people who are running the various shops and restaurants in the park, and then proceeds to spin out his vision for, you know, what he wants to do with the park going forward. And it's kind of fascinating because it's like, you know, he felt that, you know, for example, there wasn't enough stuff at Disneyland. There's lots of stuff at Disneyland that appealed to men, but not a whole lot of stuff that appealed to women. And so, you know, one of the ideas that Walt came up with, they actually reached out to the Crane Plumbing Company. And so what they did, built in Tomorrowland, was the bathroom of the future.
No.
Yes. So
what was the bathroom of the future?
It was.
It involved a gold. It was a milking machine.
Gold-plated toilet and bidet. You could, you know, the kids could spin various knobs and make, you know, water fountains flow. It took them all quite a while to figure out how to get a handle on what they could put in Tomorrowland, and this was part of that.
All right, the bathroom, you know, of tomorrow.
Bathroom of tomorrow, and again, designed to appeal to the women. Same time he announced that they were, they had just sent,
Sorry, I have to tell a side story. So Laurel and I were in Vegas at Aria, the relatively new hotel. Yep. And they've got one of these in our room. We have a nice room. Mm-hmm. They have one of these, they have a regular toilet, then they have a Japanese toilet. You've seen the one with the buttons and everything?
Yep.
So for like 2 days, the first 2 days we're there, no one uses the Japanese toilet. And then finally, over a bottle of wine, Laurel and I decide that Laurel is going to actually try it to see what happens. So she goes in, she uses it, and there's this long wait, like 5-10 minutes, like longer than you would think it would take to to use a bathroom. Mm-hmm. And she comes out, and I was like, well, you know, how is it? And she says, we must never speak of this again. And that was it. That was it. That was the entire thing. But apparently it's kind of like, yeah, like you said, it's got all these like water fountain-like features that clean various parts of your body that with different water pressures and temperatures and sensors and everything. Okay. All right. Anyway.
You know, and it's also worth noting here that another supposedly female appealing thing that was going to be added to Tomorrowland was actually the House of the Future. And,
the House of the Future.
So, you know, the Monsanto plastic house. And again, it's the whole notion of when you hear, you know, it's one thing to build it. It's another thing to, that's why they built it that way. It was supposed to appeal to women. You know, that's why we had the tour of the kitchen.
You see the video for it? There's like a 40-minute video on YouTube for it.
Yeah. And it's just kind of sad that even Walt kind of bought into the whole June Cleaver thing. It's just sort of like, yeah, that's what we need. They show the women.
So it was designed, because I've seen the video and it does actually, now that you mention it, it's true. Yeah. Because it opens with like, a mom and a daughter, mm-hmm. Making dinner.
Yep.
And it is focused on women, isn't it? Yeah, I totally get that. How about that? Okay.
And at the same time, they're looking to bring in, you know, rides that they can convince people that they have to come back to Disneyland to ride. So, you know, at this point, Disney had just sent people over to Switzerland to buy the Skyway ride that they're going to bring back to the park. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, pieces of real estate that you would have thought were opening day things. I mean, for example, Tom Sawyer's Island, you know, until 56 was just something you floated around.
Really?
You know, likewise, the Casey Jr. train, though it ran, just ran through this kind of weed-filled void. Again, same thing with the canal boats of the world, which they had to go out and actually build the storybook canal boat buildings for, you know, just to give the guests something to look at. But that's how much, you know, I, again, Disneyland really kind of had to evolve because nobody had ever built a Disneyland before.
Right.
And meanwhile, again, Walt now really starts after looking over his shoulder. Never mind CV. In 1956, CBS, which let's remember, had a shot at Disneyland, said no. Mm-hmm. Gets in bed with the Los Angeles Turf Club, the folks who run the Santa Anita Raceway, mm-hmm. and they lease the Ocean Park Pier, and that they announced their plans. They're going to build a $10 million nautical theme park called Pacific Ocean Park. And, you know, again, they stress they're going to do just what Disney did. They're going to hire the best, you know, the best amusement park designers. They're going to get the top effects people in Hollywood. And so Walt is like, all right, we've got to go to war here. So, you know, he announces, that there's a sign that goes up on Main Street that, you know, opening late in 1956 is International Street. And this was going to be built out behind between Main Street and Tomorrowland. It was going to be, honestly, the earliest iteration of a lot of the concepts that Walt, you know, the Imagineers eventually did for World Showcase. It was lots of little shops and restaurants that would, you know, you turn one corner and you'd be in London. You come around the next corner and here you are in Paris. Go around the next corner and you're in Italy.
Wow. It's like the prototype for Epcot. Wow.
Yeah.
But they never got built. This is like late 56.
Well, and that's, again, this is where it gets kind of interesting because you just get this whiff of Walt starts throwing things out there. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, you know, for Disneyland's first birthday in July 17th, 1956, they do this big info dump just to sort of, you know, make the public aware of, you know, how successful Disneyland is and mm-hmm. that how far the competition will have to come to compete with Disney. All right. So by this point, 3.6 million visitors have come to the park.
And 3.6.
Interesting thing, 41% of those came from out of state.
Wow.
The other thing, a fascinating stat, is that for every one child that came through the door, four adults came to the park.
It's the ratio it should be, man. I mean, Disney parks aren't for kids. I know that kids love them, but a lot of the design details are just you can appreciate best as an adult. Anyway,
I agree. Anyway, the top attractions of the park were Peter Pan Dark Ride in Fantasyland, Jungle Cruise. You're right.
Yeah.
Santa Fe and Disneyland Railroad. But to be honest, it's really more about you can get more people on them, and the Autopia. What got funny about the Autopia is that because there was such a demand from kids to do, you know, that they wanted to do the Autopia, that for a time there were three different Autopias in the park. They were by 57, there was the Tomorrowland Autopia. They had added the Fantasyland version along with the motorboat cruise. And there was even a junior Autopia where with midget cars, where they actually made them small enough so you're talking 3- and 4-year-olds could drive these things.
Really?
Yeah. Actually, right over where, to give you some idea of where it was located, it's kind of where, what is it, the Fantasyland Theater is located now. It fronted right there.
Oh, wow. So, wow. Three Autopias.
So, but anyway, Walt got... You know, and again, we got very concerned about, you know, the notion that Disneyland was very expensive and wanted to get out in front of that. So they put this stat out where they talked about the average guest expenditure was only $2.37. And that was parking, admissions, rides, amusements, even the souvenirs. And Walt also stressed that, yes, we have 33 rides and amusement, but there are 21 free attractions.
Wow.
You know, just that was the thing. Walt, I think it's important to stress here that back in the day, there was only one guy who called the shots. And again, that's why CV was kicked to the curb. Walt called the shots. This was Walt's personal train set, and what he wanted in the park went. Nothing else was really taken into consideration, which was why sometimes Walt's decisions were a little strange. I mean, for example, March of 56, one of the shops that opened on Main Street was Jimmy Starr's Show Business Souvenirs. And this was really the first Sid Kawanga store.
I was going to say, yeah, they had one for the longest time at the studios.
Huh. Okay. But here's the thing. The reason Walt cut the deal with Jimmy is that Jimmy had this great collection of old black and white silent movies, and Walt needed those films for the silent movie theater on Main Street.
Really? So it wasn't always Mickey Mouse cartoons?
No.
Really?
You could actually go in there and see Chaplin. You could go in and see Phantom of the Opera.
Really?
Well, again, Walt for Walt, this was about authenticity. In fact, you get a particularly bizarre piece of Disney history. You got to understand that Phantom of the Opera was made by Universal, you know, back, I want to say 1919. But if you went to Disneyland, there would be this guy with a top hat and a cape and a rubber Phantom of the Opera mask lurking in the doorway of the cinema. And, you know, you'd just come by and he would come out and jump at you.
So, I've never heard half these stories. This is amazing. Did the guy end up just getting punched every day and did he quit?
I'm not sure. But again, that was old Disneyland. And, it then became about how do we get people to come out to the park? You know, and how do we, you know, just now we're a going concern. And it's just we have to make sure that people come so that they do things like the Aunt Jemima pancake race, where, you know, women would race through the park with iron skillets flipping pancakes over ropes that were set, you know, 10 feet high over Main Street. Or the antique automobile parade that was the big thing for Easter 56. You went and suddenly here were all these classic, you know, Model Ts and that sort of thing. You know, again, private collectors had driven to Disneyland so they could parade them through the park.
Yeah.
Needed
stuff.
And that's it exactly. And at the same time, Walt was also in the process of refining what was there. I mean, for example, the stagecoaches and the mule pack ride in Tomorrowland. He shut it down for a couple of months because he felt, you know, it's like, look, we need more. And so this is when they built Rainbow Ridge. And I mean, again, Walt, you know, just, you know, started, you know, spent $400,000 to build the Rainbow Caverns just to give the park, you know, new exciting things so that people would come back.
So and, where were these caverns? This is the stuff in Thompson Island?
No, this is actually where Big Thunder Mountain Railroad is today. I mean, this is where
the old mine train thing.
There you go. And at the same time, you just get the sense that, you know, part of the reason that Walt is doing this is because he's keeping an eye on what CV is up to. And you know, CV's just gotten, you know, his first park, you know, non-Disney park going. This is Magic Mountain, which was going to be built in Colorado at the base of the Rockies at Apex Gulch. And this was – the idea was this theme park was going to celebrate the past, present, and future of Colorado. And if you do – if you take a look at the map of this thing, I mean, it's so obvious he's lifting – you know, the plans are straight from Disneyland. I mean, you have a frontier town that's basically Main Street USA.
What was the name of it? Sorry.
It's called Magic Mountain. Again, Colorado was supposed to open in 1957. And if you look at the map of this thing, you know, you have your frontier town, which goes to a cavalry fort that's, you know, if you squint, it's Disneyland Castle. I mean, it's positioned in the exact same way. More to the point, instead of a fantasy land, they have a Storybook Lane. Instead of, a Tomorrowland, they have the Magic of Industry area. And, you know, what's fascinating about this park is that they ran out of money while building it. You know, that CV didn't have the power of the Disney name. So, you know, he thought he'd be able to do what he did the last time, just sort of, you know, convince all these people to come on board.
Oh, okay. So I found a map of it online. Oh my God. Yeah. It's just, I'm looking at the artist's conception of the Magic Mountain Park. It's got a main street in the middle. It's got a lagoon where Frontierland. Oh my God. Yeah.
No, I mean, CV, you know, just,
it's almost using the same font to spell Magic Mountain.
There you go. And it, you know, right down to the train that circles the park. But they ran out of money after they built Main Street. And CV at that point had, in the classic Harold Hill tradition, had cashed his check and moved on. And the interesting thing is that you know, Magic Mountain eventually, you know, these buildings are still standing today. They reimagined what got built as Heritage Square. It's a shopping mall now.
Wow.
So anyway, meantime, again, here's Walt, once again, kind of, you know, just sort of like, okay, you know, we've got to do new stuff at the park. And even though they had announced International Street, they'd actually built sort of a look through as to where the area was going to be built on Town Square. In fact, there was a sign that said the site of future sites,
yep.
And you could look through at these tiny little models. By the time 58 rolled around, International Street was gone, and what was going to be built in its place was Liberty Street. And this is the early precursor of Liberty Square for Walt Disney World. In fact, a lot of the ideas for this, you know, for example, the Hall of Presidents, really can be dated back to, you know, this Liberty Street, though, you know, this was, you know, years and years and years before, you know, they got serious about our animatronics. So
what was the idea?
Waxworks.
Waxworks.
Well, you know, just the idea is that it was going to be telling. In fact, again, to just give you some idea of how Walt's mind works, they were working on a two-episode version of Johnny Tremaine for the Disneyland television series. And Walt was looking at the production art, you know, was looking at the models for the sets. And first thing he did is like, wow, this is too good to waste on the Disneyland TV show. Let's do this as a theatrical release.
Really?
And secondly, let's take these ideas and bring them to Disneyland. So, I mean, again, that's what's fascinating about Walt is that he was all about this kind of, you know, he was a magpie. He would see something at the studio that you'd think, you know, was going to be a movie or a TV show, and suddenly it's mutated into something that's going into the parks. But, you know, it's going to be – you know, a lot of classic crafts things. I mean, you're going to be able to see glass blowing. And again, you remember that Johnny Tremaine in the story is an apprentice of you know, Paul Revere. So, you know, you're going to be able to see a tinsmith shop and a silversmith. And again, you know, with a recreation of the Liberty Tree from Boston where they'd hang the lanterns, right. Independence Hall, even the Boston shipyards. I mean, there's a...
So this was going to be huge. Where were they? And they were doing this as models, or they were doing these as full-size things?
They were going to be doing it as a full-size thing. It was going to be, again, located behind Main Street USA and Tomorrowland. In fact, again, if you folks Google Liberty Street, there's lots of artwork out there. There's you know, I mean, they were serious. It was definitely going forward. But in the end, you know, it was one of the things where it held Walt's attention for a while. Then I think in a way, the fact that the Johnny Tremaine film came out and wasn't as popular as Walt had planned, you know, that originally Liberty Street was supposed to open in 59. And by then, you know, Walt had decided, you know, we need more thrill rides and we need more arts and crafts. And that was when the monorail, the Matterhorn, and the submarine voyage were built. But again, just what's fascinating about this period is, again, because this is you got to remember that Disneyland is basically Walt's giant train set. So he's always putting things in, you know, to make his train set more fun. So, for example, in 57, the Jungle Cruise gets an upgrade. There's a rainforest put in. You get two gorillas to menace people on the side of the river. You get the native, you know, the native war party and the dancing, you know, the natives. But this is also the first appearance of Trader Sam. You know, that's, you know, finally there's a figure at the end of the ride, but to give you some idea, that was the height of Disney animatronics at that point. You had a figure that could raise shrunken heads and put them down.
That was that's when Trader Sam first showed up, 1958.
1957.
57,
so,
okay. Wow.
Same time, you know, you've got, you know, April of 57, the Sleeping Beauty Castle walkthrough finally opens. I mean, up until this point, Sleeping Beauty Castle has just been this empty shell.
And you walk through it or no?
Well, it depended on whether the janitor left the door open or not. you know, every so often, you know, somebody would look up and there were these people walking around on the parapets. It's like, ah, damn it. Somebody forgot to lock the door.
Really? You could get up all the way into the parapets?
Yeah.
Those were the days, man. Those were the days.
So, but, you know, even then, and this is where, this is kind of a dark side of the Disney story. I mean, Disneyland really began to become most of Walt's focus. I mean, yes, he was paying attention to what they were doing on television. He was paying attention to, but not as much. In fact, you know, for example, one of the reasons that Sleeping Beauty Castle walkthrough opened in 57 was the movie was supposed to come out in 57.
Right.
And, you know, and Walt just, it wasn't ready. And because a lot of it wasn't, the reason it wasn't ready was Walt wasn't really paying attention. You know, the animators were really competing. You know, it used to be you'd see Walt, we'd work on a movie every week. And by this point in the company's history, you're lucky if you get to see Walt every month.
Really? Wow.
And so the film fell very much behind schedule and went very much over budget. And you know, in fact, when we get to 59, pretty much weeks after it opened and was declared a box office bust. In fact, I mean, just 2 or 3 weeks after Sleeping Beauty opened in theaters, the Shaggy Dog opened, and it had been produced for about a sixth of what it had cost to produce, you know, the Sleeping Beauty, and it. I think it made triple the box office.
Wow.
And so Disney actually had this huge layoff in animation that they gutted feature animation. For a while, it really looked like Disney was going to get out of that business and just, you know, concentrate on the parks. Anyway, so, but again, this is Walt, you know, that Walt does what Walt loves, you know, so it's like, you know, they need to increase capacity of the parks. Walt loves trains, so he decides they're going to get a third, you know, railroad train for the park. And, you know, so he goes out and he sends an agent out around the country to find, a steam train, and is actually able to pick up this old, disused steam train for $1,200.
Wow.
And now, mind you, he has to spend $57,000 to retool the thing and get it ready to put into the park. But, I mean, you know, just the whole notion of, all right, here's $1,200, give me your train. And meanwhile, you know, July of the same year, the Santa Monica Pier closes to begin its redo as Pacific Ocean Park. You know, and Disneyland, again, is trying to make sure that it's doing everything that guests want it to do. So, you know, first time ever on July 31st, 57, they held their first New Year's Eve party. 7,500 people turned out. And 3 weeks later.
That's like what's in the central hub.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but at the same time, recognizing that now that you know, they've been running for, you know, over 2 years at this point,
yeah,
and that guests come to the park and sometimes bring their pets, so they open the Kennel Ration Pet Motel, you know, to put it out right side the main gate.
Pets.
And then because you put your third train on the line and you got to give guests something to look at, March of 58, you open the Grand Canyon Diorama. And they spent over $350,000 building this thing. And
the Grand Canyon, so I've been on the train. I remember the Grand Canyon Diorama.
Yeah. With some of the worst, you know, taxidermy that anybody's ever seen in the planet. I mean, I'm always amazed that, you know, again, you get on this thing and it's like, I'm pretty sure turkeys don't look like that.
Yes.
You know? Or at least they aren't covered with dust. You know,
that antelope over there looks like he's more surprised than I am that I'm here.
You know, and you know, just, and again, Walt, because now he has the cash flow, he has the money, is putting things in that, you know, again, he thinks makes the park look good, makes the park look busy, gives people, guests, more options. So June of 58, the Columbia debuts. And again, Walt spent, you know, $300,000, but he got his river that now looks busy because it's not just the Mark Twain, but it's the Columbia and, you know, the Tom Sawyer's rafts and the war canoes and the Mike Fink boats.
You know, it's funny because we always think about the kinetic movement that you see as you walk through the parks, and you know, to us, you know, when you walk into Disneyland now, it's been there for 60 years. A lot of the stuff that you've seen has been tested to be, you know, crowd friendly and work in a theme park environment for 50 or 60 years. But it's funny to hear that back in the day, there was no master plan. Nobody's consulting, like, you know, textbooks called The Psychology of Crowds or whatever to tell you that there's, you know, that movement makes things interesting. They figure this out stuff, and it sounds like it's through some combination of intuition, you know, what wants something to move, and trial and error.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. But at the same time, don't forget ego. I mean, for example, July 28th, 1958, Pacific Ocean Park finally opens, and what's one of their central attractions? The Deepest Deep, which is a simulated on dry land voyage of a submarine. Huh. And, you know, and
a simulated submarine voyage.
There you go.
And
the interesting thing is that on opening day, for the first 6 days that Pacific Ocean Park is open, it does better business than Disneyland. And of course, the people who are running Pacific Ocean Park, CVS, and oddly enough, one of the big investors in this thing was Lawrence Welk. So, you know, he hypes that. And again, this kind of sticks in Walt's craw. So it's just sort of, all right, so they're going to do a simulated on land submarine voyage. We're going to do a real submarine voyage. So, you know, he sends Roger Brogy and Joe Fowler over to Germany, and they're checking out the Alway company for the monorail. But again, you know, think about it. This, we've talked about how long has it taken to build Avatar Land?
Oh, it'll be 7 years, I think, by the time it opens, right?
Okay. So picture this. Pacific Ocean Park opens July 28th, 1959. All right. We jump ahead a year, you know, or actually less than a year, July 14th, 1959.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Walt, in that time, has not only built the monorail and the submarines, he's also built the Matterhorn, which is this 100th scale, you know, version of the Matterhorn, you know, the famous mountain.
Yeah. The Swiss Alps.
Yeah, and put it, you know, again, we're talking 1,275 steel girders, every one of them cut to a different length. It's, the total cost of the build of this is $1.5 million. And again, backs this up with a live television, or excuse me, they learned the hard way. They weren't going to go live because of, if you've seen the original Disneyland opening day, you know, things went a little south a couple times. So this time was pre-recorded. But again, 90-minute long television special that coincidentally was timed to go on the air just ahead of the opening of C.V. Wood's next park, which was Pleasure Island, just outside of Boston, which again, once again, ripped off, you know, Disneyland in a big way. I mean, again, instead of coming through Main Street USA, you are now in sort of a knockoff Cape Cod New England village that, you know, you walk to the end of the street, and instead of the Jungle Cruise, you now sail off in search of Moby Dick. I mean, it's all of this stuff that, you know, but again, it's all about Walt establishing that, look, I have competition, but I am the king of themed entertainment. And he would take any idea and anything that he saw and would put it in the park. I mean, take, for example, August 1st, 1958, they have a Disney night at the Hollywood Bowl. It's this evening of Disney music, and, you know, that and he packs it with celebrities. I mean, for example, when they perform the Ballad of Davy Crockett, who comes out on stage in full Crockett regalia but Fess Parker. And the evening's entertainment ends with they've set a wire up from the top of the Hollywood Bowl, and Tiny Klein, and her real name's Helen Klein, this aerialist dressed as Tinkerbell jumps off of the thing and slides over the crowd. And
is that's the origin of it?
That's the origin. Walt was sitting in the audience that night and said, like, that is cool.
I feel like doing this nightly in the parks.
And that's three years later that became, you know, the beginning of the fireworks. But again, this is Walt. This is how Walt does things. That, you know, this is you know, this is his personal park, and he makes the decisions. And in fact, it was actually this brings us to kind of what happens next. But Walt really began to chafe at the notion that ABC was definitely starting to be a pain in his butt. I mean,
so I was going to ask you about this. So the park's been open. It's what? It's late 58, early 59. Park's been open 3.5 years. ABC's got to be looking at this, and they own what? A third. They're getting a third of the gate.
Yep.
It's all of the concession revenue.
Particularly the food, and that coupled with the fact that on the television side of things, you know, that for example, those two other television series that you know, Walt had created for ABC, the Mickey Mouse Club, which was run in the afternoon as a strip, and Zorro, though both of these shows are popular, ABC decides to cancel the Mickey Mouse Club in its fourth season, and kind of loses enthusiasm for Zorro. And Walt, you know, it's one of these things. We produce these things that they're top quality shows. You should put them out there. He actually turns around and sues ABC.
Really, his partner.
And, you know, eventually they come to terms. You know, he gets damages in the settlement. But, you know, part of the deal is that ABC forbids him to sell Zorro or the Mickey Mouse Club to any other networks at that point.
So it's dead at that point.
And this is the thing. It's like, here's this company that's taking, it's a third of Disneyland. He's getting all of his food revenue. And
they're telling him what to do on the TV side.
And it's just, it's one of these things where it's like, you know, this is Walt. Walt doesn't like being told what to do, particularly by, you know, people who are, you know, again, ABC is based out of New York at this point.
Right.
And it's just all this money going east. It's just sort of like really starts to get at him.
Yeah.
So, you know, and meanwhile, he's systematically taking control of places within the park that had previously been, you know, booked by other spots. I mean, for example, just the gentleman we talked about, Jimmy Starr, the show business souvenirs. His shop closes September 59. Walt takes that open and makes it into a Disney-owned gift shop. You know, likewise over in Tomorrowland, the World Beneath His exhibit, which was what was that? It was sponsored by Richfield Oil. He takes it over, and again, that becomes a Disney-owned thing. He's slowly starting to take control of his park. And as they're looking at ABC, he turns to Roy and says, we need to do something about ABC, which is the story we'll get to in the next installment.
Oh, fantastic. Wow. It's a great show, Jim. I mean, so much stuff that I've never heard before in any of this stuff. Wow, and a cliffhanger, too. I love it.
Well, we aims to please. So.
Great job. Yeah, really, really good episode. Cool. All right, you've been listening to the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Please go on to iTunes and rate us and let us know what you'd like to hear next. This was our second February episode. Our next one will be on March 1st. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care, guys.